Extreme cold weather advisory in effect this morning.
You're a contractor. You have a contract.
All right, guys, come on. Let's do this.
A little snow and ice isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all, too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.
Welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. There's been this, man, it feels like, many-decade conversation about what it means to be a nice guy and the toxicity of nice guys and nice guys finish last. I think this conversation is actually really important in the context of men, you know, because there is a large conversation about men being more avoidant. And I think if you look at the research and the history of that, that's true. That makes sense from a socialization perspective, etc. But it seems to be that there is a shift happening. And I've heard this from lots of people that, you know, maybe because of the conversations about gender roles and more women, you know, graduating with degrees and being the primary breadwinners, etc., there's a lot of shifting in how we arrange relationally. And there's also a lot of conversation about women and men switching spots in terms of women actually becoming more avoidant and men being more anxious. Now, the context and subject of today's conversation with a world-renowned expert in the space of men. And his book, and his name is Robert Glover, his book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, had a profound impact on me. One of my favorite quotes from him is that if you don't stand up to her, she doesn't believe you'll stand up for her. And I think that's a really powerful quote, that if you don't stand up to her, she won't believe you'll stand up for her. And this idea that if we don't have a backbone, if we don't stand in our truth, then people won't trust us because innately we won't be trustworthy. And this is where we unconsciously test people in relationship. Now, regardless of whether you're a man or a woman, or you date men or women, the pathology of what makes someone become a quote-unquote nice guy or nice girl, but the things that shape each gender culturally will be quite different, or maybe from like movies and books and, you know, whatever it might be. If we're growing up in religious places, the country we grow up in, those all obviously have an impact on it. So today's episode is going to rock your socks and blow your mind. I can't wait. He's one of the best teachers. He's great to interview. Just incredible. Funny, all the things. Straight shooter. No effing around. And you know I love that. So make sure wherever you're listening to this podcast, hit that subscribe button. As I said, I'm going to be doing fewer guest interviews, but when I do them, they're only going to be the best of the best. And I don't want you to miss any future episodes, but mainly they'll be solo episodes moving here on out. And there'll be a few more guest ones coming through. But with all that said, please share this episode with anyone you think it might be helpful with. If you could share it on socials and tag me, I would love that. I'm really investing more time into growing the podcast and getting into more people's ears, and I need your help to do that. So with all that said, much love and appreciation. Let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. This one is a long time coming. Dr. Robert Glover has been in my orbit for, oh man, it's over 10 years that I read your book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, and I felt...
Why did it take so long to invite me onto your show? What was that about?
Listen, I was playing hard to get. You just didn't know about it.
Yeah, I certainly didn't chase you. You finally got over yourself.
Exactly.
I said, Robert, will you come on my podcast? I said, of course.
Well, there was a... I was thinking initially like, oh, this guy's like too big. This is an...
Oh, I love hearing that.
Yeah, well, there was that sort of thought. And then when Connor had you on a few times, I was like, Connor...
You thought, if Connor can get me, you can get me.
Right? Yeah, I was like, can you facilitate an intro? And yeah, I was... really positively. I wish I had reached out sooner, but it's the perfect time. So thanks for being on.
It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation. And, you know, I think Connor's an amazing human being. So I'm glad we have that bridge between us.
Yeah, me too. And I was really drawn to the title, obviously, of your book is pretty direct, tells you exactly what you're going to get into. And I found that your work drew a line in a really beautiful way of me actually understanding what shapes nice guy behavior that's beyond just, let's say, a relationship with a parent. So I'm curious, what made you write the book?
I guess as if most things in my life, it wrote itself in some ways. Mm. Most things in my life find me, grab hold of me, you know, and say, here I am. You know, what made me write it? I did not see myself as a writer. And it was wasn't even after the book was published and been out for a few years that it dawned on me. I'm a writer. I'm a published author. It took me a while to even sink that in. But what happened is kind of the story begins with my second wife basically saying, you need help. And if you don't get help, I'm leaving you. And I thought I was such a nice guy. And she said, everybody thinks you're a nice guy, but you're not. She says, you're passive aggressive. You lie to me. I can't trust you. You don't follow through. You embarrass me. You cut me down. You hurt me. She said, you need help. And I thought, well, you're the one who's unhappy all the time and hates yourself. And, you know, is always angry and doesn't want to have sex anymore. But okay, I'll get help. I didn't want to lose her. And I, you know, to kind of keep the story short, I've told it many times, I just ended up in some good places where I learned to start being more vulnerable and more transparent and just started discovering that my paradigm of just trying to be the good guy, trying to be different from my father and all those bad men I'd heard women complain about since I was two and started listening to my mother complain about my father. And then the growing up with the angry feminism of the 60s and 70s, where every man's a rapist, an erection's a sign of aggression. I saw bumper stickers like that. Wow. And by the time a guy hits junior high, here's all the girls complaining about those jerks that only want one thing. But they sure do talk about those jerks a lot, keep going back to them. And I just didn't want to be that guy, whatever that meant. Don't be that guy. And as a marriage and family therapist in my practice, as I started working on me and seeing of my nice guy paradigm, if I just go along to get along, if I just avoid conflict, if I just try to make people happy, if I'm just generous, then everything, I'll be liked and loved to get my needs met. That's what I thought. All this nice, smooth life. And when I realized other men were saying the same thing, they'd come to me for therapy with their wife, their girlfriend. They say, I'm a nice guy. I'm one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I do everything for her. I treat her better than her ex. I'm raising her kids. They go to a private school. I buy her the car she wants with the leather interior. We take the trip she wants. It's never enough. It's never good enough. She's always complaining. When's it going to be my turn? She doesn't want to have sex anymore. And I thought, wow, I can finish these guys' sentences. So I was thinking about this just a couple of days ago. It's probably been about 30 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, that I started my first No More Mr. Nice Guy men's group based with these guys. We met every other Wednesday. I just started putting Wednesdays aside to just write. I'm a systems analyst by nature. My mother's that way. I'm that way. My son's that way. My granddaughter's that way. We all think and gather information and seek answers and solutions in much the same way. And for me, yeah, what? Why? Why is this? Why is this phenomena here? Why doesn't it work? What would work better? How do we fix it? And so I just kind of just started writing to these guys, and they and their girlfriends and wives said, Robert, you need to write a book. You need to go on Oprah. This could be a bestseller. A lot of people need it. So over about 6 to 7 years, I was learning to be a writer, learning about nice guy syndrome, because nobody had ever written about codependency in men before. Mm-hmm. In fact, codependency was even in itself was a relatively new concept at that time. But most of it was directed at people in addictions studies,
right,
and then towards women. And I intentionally did not use the word codependent in the book because I didn't want people to come to it with a preconceived idea or say, oh, codependency. Well, I'm not an addict or with an addict, and I'm not
this
a woman.
This is an Al-Anon. Yeah.
Yeah. So I intentionally did not use the word, but that is what we're talking about, codependency, or my preferred term, borrowed functioning. Where I need you to be a certain way for me to have value and identity or purpose. And so that's what nice guys are doing. We're getting our identity, our value and purpose, typically from external type things. It might be internal, like, well, I'm smart or I'm successful. Now, do I get noticed now? Do I get valued? Do I get appreciated? So our value comes from that. Or I find a person who seems like they could use some fixing up. I fix them up. Oh, you'll appreciate me. I get value from that. And I get my identity from the fact that I help you and help fix you up. Now, there's certain fundamental flaws with that. If I pick you because you seem to have some issues I can help you with, I can help you get over your depression or get your car paid off or, you know, start getting along better with coworkers. If that's where I get my identity and value and purpose, I'm going to need you to keep having those problems so I can keep getting, even though I'm saying I want you to get over all of that. So then you'll be this, you know, great companion for me and you'll have your shit together and you can be there for me. I don't want that because then, well, who am I? What's my value or purpose and identity if you don't even need me to fix anything? So, I mean, it's more than just that, but that's a significant chunk of nice guy syndrome. So I just started writing. 6 or 7 years took me. If I published everything I'd written, it'd be about that thick. Luckily, I had a good editor that helped me kind of get it down to about that thick. Took about 3 years to get the book published. We shopped to several big publishing companies and several editors said, Robert, we love your book. It's a great book. It's well written. But they all said the same thing. Our marketing department says men won't buy a self-help book. And I said, how can they buy them if you don't publish them? Right. And I said, you don't know these guys that I'm writing to. They do want to be good men. They're looking for answers. And that was pre-Amazon mostly, pre-Kindle readers, pre-podcast where, you know, somebody hears a book on a podcast, clicks on the link in the show notes, goes to Amazon. Amazon says people who bought this book and this book. Yeah. Now, I don't know if men actually read the books, but they do buy them. You know, because my royalty checks keep getting bigger every year. So either there's more and more nice guys out there or more people are talking about it, word of mouth podcasts, or men are buying a lot of books.
Yeah, it makes sense that, you know, it's almost like the publisher is part of the problem in that.
There's a reason why print publishing has been in the toilet for, you know, 20, 25 years. They don't make money anymore. All the money in publishing, unless you have a really big hit, big author, big name, you know, name person, maybe like a Mel Robbins comes along, you know, all right, big hit. But most money in publishing is made through digital, through the audiobooks and through Kindle type readers. But print publishing is almost guaranteed to lose money. I mean, you're going to print up a bunch of books, you know, ship them somewhere, put them on a bookshelf in a store where they got to pay utilities and there's only so much space. They don't get bought. They tear the cover off it. They send it back to the publisher. They destroy it.
Right.
Not a very good model, but it's just, it is what it's been for quite some time. But anyway, without getting too far down the rabbit hole of publishing, there's apparently a lot of guys out there who do find, you know, do find what they're looking for in the book and you know, many other books as well. So I'm grateful for that. When I started my own nice guy recovery, probably about all there was like Iron John, you know, Robert Bly's book, which great was book. Good. And it was a good start, but I'm grateful that there's a lot more we have to go on now.
Yeah. I think the specificity of your work is really important. Like when I was reading your book, I was, you know, going through obviously my own development, thinking about how I grew up in the 80s and 90s. I had the message that men are bad, rapists, murderers, and I have a really good father. Like my father is emotionally connected, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He spoke to me about emotional problems, but I found myself with that righteous perspective of I'm going to be different than other men. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be like these other guys. There's the cultural message that I'm really not wanting to participate in. I want to be different. I want to be part of the feminist resolution of men. Good and I was enmeshed with my mother. So,
me too.
Right. So I was the youngest in the family and I started to see like, you know, unconsciously, my mom feeling overwhelmed with 3 kids, et cetera, was this desire, like if mom is calm and good, everything's good.
Yeah.
And my early...
Did you decide also to never be a moment's problem, to not be an extra strain or burden on another? Did you do that route too?
Yeah. It's almost like it's a perfect developmental recipe, hey?
Yeah. If I take care of mother, then maybe she'll have enough energy and bandwidth left over to, you know, give a little bit back to me. And then I'll be special. She'll prize me for being that special child.
And in a way, I got that, you know, like I got the like favoritism I desired. And
I did too. But, you know, it wasn't until after I got out of college and got to be a young adult to think, you know what? I actually never got anything out of that deal.
Right.
You know, my mother paid my brother's rent for him. My mother paid my sister's college. You know, I got scholarships. I worked. I paid. I thought, wait a minute. How come, you know, I was the favored child. I was never a moment's problem. Oh, if I'm never a moment's problem, she doesn't have to give me anything.
Right.
You know, she gives it all to the other kids.
It's a bad strategy.
That was not the best survival strategy.
Well, I found with my early relationships too, you know, betrayals experienced in them. And I just didn't have access to the anger that was necessary to say, this isn't okay. And found myself in circumstances that in hindsight, I have compassion for, because they're exactly where you end up being betrayed when you follow a series of self-betrayals, mm-hmm. you know? And so I ended up in circumstances where I'm like, I was so disconnected from anger, yet I think a lot unconsciously, I wanted the woman to finally notice my pain so she would then alter her behavior. When I looked in hindsight, I'm like, God, I feel like each one of them was like, are you in there? Like, do you have, yeah.
How bad do, you ever get do mad? I have to act to get a reaction from you? And that's so, I hear you, because we're thinking we're being good by not reacting.
Yeah.
Bad men react. Bad men slap them around, you know, this, that, you know, but bad men lose their temper. So we're not being, and they're just trying to get a reaction that says what they do actually means something to us. And we're just thinking we're doing the right thing. But for example, I was in my mid-30s in my second marriage and already had a PhD in marriage and family therapy before I ever even heard of boundaries. I went to a therapist.
Not wild.
First session with this woman therapist, she's a little bit older, well, probably quite a bit older than me. And first session, she gets a string out on the ground, puts it down, starts doing this little exercise with me around boundaries. I don't know if she did that with everybody in their first session, or she thought, this guy needs the boundary exercise. I had no clue that you could say, no, stop. I'm going to get off the phone now. Call me back when you're in a better mood. Or if you ever do that again, we're done. Or I am done. I didn't know you could do that. And I've come to realize I'm part of 99.9% of the population, because children don't grow up with any concept of boundaries. What we all grow up with generally is a concept of the big people get to do whatever they want to the little people. Mm-hmm. You know, they can make you go to bed when they want. They can spank you if they want. They can ground you if they want. They can take away privileges if they want. They can embarrass you in the classroom if they're your teacher. If they're policemen, they can do whatever they want. If it's older siblings or older neighbor kids, they can beat on you if they want. They can, you know, the big people get to do what they want to the little people. So what happens for almost all of us, we start out as little people, you know, being the recipient of whatever the big people want to do. And then when we grow into be big people, we're like, I guess, like that elephant that got staked down to the ground when he was small. Now he can easily pull the stake out of the ground and move. We don't know that, because we've been conditioned as you just put up with it. At least for me, it was all right. If I just am patient, go along, don't piss her off, don't upset her, they'll quit doing this bad thing. They'll come around. They'll see, as you said, that it's hurting me. They'll just know that it's the wrong thing to be doing. If I just, and you know, I would just keep all of that in as well. I know what would happen for me, like with my second wife, is that it would finally, you know, it built until it would blow up, and it would come gushing out of me. And mm-hmm. she called that a victim puke. And it was, I mean, everything I'd rehearsed in my head up till then, everything I didn't say, it all got said, and, you know, probably not very kindly. And, you know, when we'd get through that, she sometimes asked me later, she said, how long had that been bothering you? I don't know, 6 months maybe. She goes, 6 months? Did it ever cross your mind to tell me about it? No, never even thought that was an option. And I thought, well, but if I did tell you, you'd probably just get pissed at me for telling you, because that's usually what happened. So that was my experience. You just keep it in and you go along. And my ex used to tell me, she said, I'm just a little girl making noise. And if you can't stand up to me, how do I know you'll ever stand up for me? And she would even say, you know what? I hate it when you let me treat you badly, because then I feel like a bitch afterwards. And I don't like feeling that way. So then I'm actually kind of pissed at you that you let me treat you badly. And I'm going, how does the math on that work? But she was right, you know, that me letting someone treat me badly is an unloving act towards both myself and them. And that just took a long time to really come to understand that if I actually can invite the people around me into a higher consciousness and greater awareness rather than just tolerating what they do and hope it ends at some point, I'm doing everybody a loving favor if I can do that with love and with consciousness. But that also takes quite a bit of practice and quite a long time, especially when we've all been conditioned, just keep it in and, you know, either just try to fix, go along to get along, or just keep running away. You know, we don't really have a lot of options that say, we have to have a conversation. You know, This can't continue. We have to find answers. We're just not taught that as children.
No, and it's ironic too that, you know, in taking that stand, you're taking a stand for love, you're taking a stand for a standard. But, you know, I think when I look back at the way that manifested in my relationships was this fear of, you know, if I do take a stand for that, I'm going to lose them. But I was
exactly.
But I had such a sense, like I was so used to not having a full sense of self in relationship that the self was abandoned. So now if I lose them and I lose me, not realizing now, of course, I have the awareness that I actually end up continuing to gain and trust myself, even if I lose them. But that when you're 20 and 19 and we haven't read your book, we haven't
47.
Had this conversation, right? Yeah.
You know, well, kind of an illustration of that in kind of a roundabout way. My first two marriages lasted a total of about 25 years. One was about 10-ish, one about 14-ish. And I know a fundamental reason, there are probably many reasons I stayed much longer than I should in both. Pretty much every relationship I've been in, my present wife is an exception. At some point in the relationship, the woman dug in her heels and basically said, don't expect anything more. Don't, you know, she might have been through their action. They might have said it. And it's, and whether they said it or not, looking back, I knew at some point, you know, because I was actually trying harder to drag that anchor behind me. But their heels were dug in. Don't expect me to be kinder. Don't expect me to be more affectionate. Don't expect more sex. Don't expect me to, you know, actually talk with you about what's bothering me instead of just clamming up and not saying a word. Don't expect it. That's all, you know. And one of the things I've said is that, unfortunately, most of us will choose our neuroses and defense mechanisms over love. I mean, I was just wanting to love these partners. I married them because I love them. And I just wanted us, and in my mind, I'm always going to work on me. And I'm thinking, well, they will too. I'm that kind of optimist. And when I found out that, no, they're going to choose their neuroses and their defense mechanisms over working on themselves to facilitate a greater flow of love and growth, I would stay around way too long after that. And I know one of the reasons I would stay, going back to that not having a sense of a self in there, is that even though in many ways I was over-functioning, I was that borrowed function, I was over-functioning for everybody in the relationship. I was, you know, I was doing all the heavy lifting. But yet, even though I could take care of me, her, everybody else involved, I did not know I could just take care of me. I didn't have a knowing if I was alone, on my own, by myself, single guy, I had no clue, could I even just take care of me? Would I survive? And I didn't really realize. I had inklings of that. I kind of suspected it because the way I would just, my second marriage, I just kept giving it 6 more months to get better. I was leaving. That just kept rolling over, right? And for 14 years, that I rolled that over. And finally, when I got out there on my own and realized, you know, say a couple years into that experiment of being a single guy living on my own, I thought, what was I so afraid of? I was not only taking care of me, but everybody else, but I didn't think I could just take care of me by myself because I didn't know there was a competent me in there. And I didn't find that till I was pushing 50 and out there on my own going, this is actually kind of nice. I kind of like this. I kind of like there just being a me here that, you know, is enjoying life on his terms. And then the women that came into my life on my terms that, you know, because there was a me there and the women liked it better that way, that there was a me there and
strange
came into my life on my terms. One of the things I started doing when I was dating, after I kind of, you know, got good at dating and met a number of good women along the way, after we'd been on a few dates and it looked like we would keep dating, I would tell the women, if we keep seeing each other, here's what you can expect of me. I said, I'll be conscious. I'll pay attention. I'll pay attention to you, to me, to us, to what's going on. I'll be honest. Everything I will tell you will be the whole truth, nothing but the truth. You won't ever find out I left anything out or, you know, fudged on any of it. I'll be transparent. You'll know what I think, what I feel, what I want, where I'm going, what I expect of you. And I said, I will set the tone and take the lead. I'll show up with a plan. I won't burden you with that. And every woman I told that to, maybe three or four different women, all of them got this look like, I think every one of them said, I've never had a man tell me that before. And I had a few of them say, you need to write another book because you need to tell men what you're doing. And all of that, of those things I said I would do, came out of a sense of me. I knew who I was. I knew where I was going. I knew what I wanted in my life. I knew what companions, you know, I wanted, what assets, resources. And the women would all say, and this is a good sign, the women would say, okay, that's what I can expect of you. What do you expect of me? And I said, you know, I got pretty much everything covered. Love my work. I travel. I got good guy friends. I enjoy my life. I take care of myself. I said, just treat me well and make my world beautiful. And every one of those women, you know, they kind of, you know, where you look up to that corner, that's the creative thought. How can I treat him well and make his world beautiful? Every one of them responded to that, like, okay, I know what my role is. And they embraced that because of what I offered them. They go, I can show up and treat you well and make your world beautiful. But that was, there had to be a sense of me to say, that's what I need and want from you. But and again, it took me into my 50s before I got to that place. But it shifted my whole dynamic with women. And my wife and I have been married 8.5 years now. We don't speak the same language. I've learned Spanish in my 50s and 60s. She's Mexican. She just does such an amazing job of treating me well and making my world beautiful. And I think I've done a pretty good job blessing her life as well. But there has to be two whole people in that process, yeah. not looking to the other to get their borrowed functioning or identity or value. Now, we can be interdependent on each other, but there's got to be two whole people doing that.
Yeah, I'm curious, first off, that direction that you talked about of being so clear in the dating process, I can imagine, you know, when I'm married now to a woman that I've directed that sense of clarity and leadership, although I have found that when I've gotten stressed, I'll like almost push it onto her sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, that's okay.
And she We're loves human. Taking the masculine, so I have to like
that. My woman can take the masculine with the best of them. She grew up 8 out of 10 kids in poverty in Guadalajara, Mexico. She's had to fight and struggle, and she dropped out of high school at 15 to work because she didn't ever have clothes or shoes to wear to school. She's been a bodybuilder since she was 15. She can out squat me, out deadlift me. She's done Muay Thai. She's done kickboxing. I grew up in white bread suburb of Seattle, Washington, bunch of Boeing engineers families, playing soccer, you know, maybe been in two fights in my life, you know, good educational system. And yeah, that woman can fucking kick my ass. Just ask anybody that knows us, you know, in any form of the word of kick my ass, physically, emotionally, intellectually, you know, and yeah, of course, there's so many strong women out there who, since they were little girls and dad didn't show up to create a container, dad wasn't dependable, dad couldn't be trusted. Every boy they've ever been with, you know, told them what they thought they wanted to hear to get what they wanted. And yeah, they women out there have learned to be strong. They've had to be strong just because there's been no conscious men that they could actually put some trust into. So yeah, a lot of strong women.
Well, you realize how actually attractive what you're saying is. Like, it's so paradoxical because we think that level of direction and assertiveness of self is like, oh, what happens if she, and it's, what if she doesn't like it? But inevitably, it's like an aphrodisiac, the level of direction and clarity. And I'm curious, when you think of the pathology of nice guy syndrome, maybe we could like get into what tends to shape that, but then also, yeah, like how do we begin to even trust, like other than it being like a pickup artist manual, right, that says become this assertive guy, but you're really full of shit and it's just more manipulation. How do we actually embody the level of assertiveness and direction that you're talking about that is loving, open, and negotiable without it being, you know, both rigid or porous.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course it's negotiable. It's not like my way or the highway. I'm the guy, so we're doing it my way. But you know, like my wife tells me, she says, I love it when you tell me no. And, you know, we'll go into a restaurant here in Mexico and the waiters will ask her in Spanish, should they give me an English menu? She says, no, he's in Mexico. He can order in Spanish. Then they'll give her a menu. And she goes, no, he's my boss. He'll order for me. And I always joke, yeah, I get to be the boss when she says I can. The waiters always laugh at that. But she likes that strength. But by no means does she want me to control her or say, you have to do this, or we're going to do it this way. You know, you might wear the highway. It's not what she's looking for. And that's not what I want.
Right.
But I will start the ball rolling, or if I don't know what's best. Like today I said, what are you thinking for dinner? I said, should we just stick with leftovers again like we did yesterday? And she goes, yeah, we got a lot in the fridge still. So I didn't say we're having leftovers tonight.
Right.
But I started a conversation and I suggested, you know, very real, because she has dance class tonight. So she has to leave at 8 o'clock for that. And so it worked. It was that easy to find confirmation. But if I just said, what are we having for dinner tonight? You know, and left her with it. She could do it. She could handle it. She'd figure it out. But she liked it that I actually threw a starting point out there in the discussion. So that's all we're talking about.
You know that feeling you get when you crawl into a freshly made bed of silky bed sheets? It's probably my favorite feeling in the world. I've been traveling a lot lately, and every time I go to sleep in another bed, I miss my home. I miss my cozy earth sheets. I gotta tell you, these are the best high-quality sheets I've ever had the pleasure of sleeping on. And even my wife, Kylie, will agree, there are no other sheets that compare. They're soft, they're silky, and so comfortable, and you literally just melt into them. The reason they're so soft is that they're made from viscose from bamboo fabrics, which is softer than cotton. And as a huge bonus, it's responsibly and sustainably sourced. On top of that, it's temperature regulating, which means it keeps you cool and comfy all night long. And the unbeatable luxury feel helps turn your bed into the most cozy sanctuary ever. And I'm not the only one who's crazy about them. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's favorite list 7 years in a row. So give their sheets or any of their awesome products a try. They have a 10-year warranty on all their products and a 100-night sleep test to try it for 100 nights. And if you don't love it, you get your money back. But I know you'll love it as much as I do. And they're offering you, my listeners, a massively generous 40% off discount. So go to CozyEarth.com and use Mark at checkout for 40% off all their products. That's CozyEarth.com and use the code Mark for 40% off.
So to go back to your question, I've been working at this for, like I said, I was doing the math the other day, maybe up to close to 35 years when I started working on me. I'm still working on me. You know, guys will say, well, how long will this take? And I'll go, I'll let you know when I find out.
Yeah, same for me.
It's kind of like saying, well, how long do I have to keep going to the gym? Well, I guess till you're done, I guess.
Yeah.
I'll keep doing this stuff. It's just part of the journey. And my journey has taken different, you know, paths and different routes. One thing that I would say to all nice guys is I think a starting point has to be is that you go find safe people and start trusting and opening up and revealing. Because I believe nice guy syndrome is probably driven by two core factors, shame and anxiety. In No More Mr. Nice Guy, I primarily wrote about the shame parts of that. By the time I'd finished writing the book and it was being published, I was still working on me, still working with, I was doing 5 men's groups a week, so still working with a lot of guys. Yeah. And every time I bring up anxiety and soothing anxiety, can we talk about that again? I thought, okay, anxiety is a big part of nice guy syndrome. The shame part, I realize, if you've inaccurately internalized a belief that says, I'm not okay, I'm not good enough, I'm bad, I'm unlovable. And that's an inaccurate belief we all do at some age in childhood. Probably everybody does. Then we develop some coping mechanism for that sense I'm not good enough, for that unlovable, I'm bad. And nice guy, nice girls, it's just one way of doing that. We might become a high performer. We might become oppositionally defiant. We may just isolate. I mean, there's a lot of ways to deal with that sense of I'm not okay just as I am. And I think we all struggle that. Even with the best of parents, we probably still internalize, well, a little girl might say, I'm not as pretty as Jennifer. or a guy says, well, I can't hit the ball like, you know, Jack does, whatever. Mm-hmm. So we'll always find something. Children do that to internalize, I must not be good enough. And so we develop our coping mechanisms. That's what neuroses is a way of trying to cope with these things that originate when we're pretty helpless and dependent little children. And then we just keep trying to do that as adults when we're not helpless and dependent anymore. So that they don't really serve us well. And hanging on to our shame, most of us don't know the shame's even there. I didn't. I remember my ex-wife reading me John Bradshaw, Healing the Shame That Binds You. And she goes, oh, this is you. This is you. I go, what? And she'd read it. And I go, I don't even understand that, let alone apply it to me. And yeah, I already had my doctorate in marriage and family therapy, and I'm not a dumb guy. I just didn't even understand what shame was. And I go, that sounds more like you. You're the one that hates yourself. And what had happened, I just had locked my sense of not okayness so far down in such a airtight compartment that I wasn't conscious of it. Now, some people are. Some people walk around going, I'm terrible. I'm horrible. Nobody could love me. If anybody gets close to me, they're going to find out what a loser I am, how boring I am, how inefficient, how unwhatever. You know, there's some people walking around with that, and their shame's right there. Mine's way down here. And so I actually had to go to a place where I just started telling stuff about me that I'd never told anybody. The stuff that I thought, oh, I don't want anybody to know that. Mm-hmm. So I found that safe place in 12-step with therapists, men's group, and I'm still doing it to this day. I still have my own men's program that I'm in, my men's support groups. I am still in that active process of revealing the things about me that I really don't want anybody to know. And every time I think I've cleared it all out, I've talked on so many interviews. You're my second interview today. You know, I'll have another one tomorrow. I had a couple earlier in the week. You know, I had a workshop here this weekend. I tell all this stuff. And then something will come along and go, I don't really want to tell anybody that. And I do. To begin, I think, any kind of process of finding ourself and finding our power and finding our identity and showing up in the world, we've got to clear out those internalized emotional beliefs. Sometimes they're very verbal, but they're based on an emotional, kind of like the machine language of our nervous system. You're not good enough. You're going to get found out. Who are you? Oh, don't think that way. Oh, you're that's just your ego. Whatever, to where, you know, we just hold back. So I think releasing shame frees us up to be all that we are and to take risk and be vulnerable and be bold and live our biggest lives. Because if we don't do that, I think we're dragging our own anchor around that says, oh, I'm not good enough. Or we'll substitute ego or neuroses or both for internal power. Mm-hmm. And that usually won't serve us or take us where we want to go or serve the world or the people around us. So that is where I always say to start. Start working on the shame. And you can't do that alone. You can't just read a book. You can't just write it in a journal. You got to go tell people. You actually have to risk them looking at you going, you're fucked up.
Yeah.
You're a pervert. You're evil. Yeah. You're going to hell. We actually have to risk that to let it out. And then if we are truly with safe people, they'll go, thank you for sharing that. You know, they'll have empathy. They'll understand. Maybe even give us feedback to say, you're not bad. Actually, you're really normal. You know, what you just shared, I've heard that 1,000 times. You're like everybody else. Oh, I'm not terminally unique. I'm not terminally bad. No, you're actually really normal. Oh, what a relief. I'm normal. So we've got to have that place. I'm just such a big advocate of those safe spaces to go be vulnerable. I think that's a secret sauce of personal growth, whether it's in therapy, with a coach, in a group, whatever. We've got to have the safe places to go risk revealing ourselves.
Do you find that for men that first step is with men, and for women that first step is with women? Like, do you find that's the most valuable? Or
I suspect so. When I was doing marriage therapy, I used to tell couples that walked in my office, I said, the best thing you can do for your marriage is each of you have good same-sex friends. Mm-hmm. I think this myth of a couple being each other's best friend, I think that's actually does a lot of damage, because then guys get lazy in this way. I don't mean that as a judgment. It's just kind of what we do.
Yeah, it's just true.
Women tend to hold on to their friends in relationship.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, women may alternate. This morning, we're taking the walk with the dog, and my wife saying, I said, you going to spin class? No, I'm not going to spin class. I go, why? I thought you like going on Tuesday and Thursdays. Oh, Carmen did this thing that hurt my feelings. Carmen is the teacher of the Spain class. And Carmen's also somebody she goes out dancing with. And Carmen's also somebody that gets drunk and you know, can say things. She hurt my feelings. And I've learned not to argue with that. Next week, she'll be hanging out with Carmen or going to the Spain class. You know, yeah. Women will do that. I mean, they may go through periods of pushing them away, but then, you know, they work it out. We men, when we get in a relationship, we just kind of forget we have guy friends. I've got a good guy friend. I was talking to another friend who knows both of us just a couple nights ago. And we drove out. They were down here on vacation. And my wife and I went and spent time with him and his girlfriend. And he said, how are you? And he said, my friend's name. I said, you know, we're good, but we really don't talk much anymore. I said, I've been busy. You know, I've got a lot going on. But I said, and he's got a new girlfriend. And he's kind of Disneyland dad with his girlfriend, kind of like he is with his 9-year-old daughter. And he's divorced. And you know, I said, he'll be back around sooner or later. I said, guys, we always do this. You know, as soon as, you know, if we get a new relationship or we go through a breakup of a relationship or a new job or new this, you know, we forget we've got guy friends. Mm-hmm. So luckily I've got a pretty good staple of 25 plus good friends in my life. I used to only have about one and a half until I joined a men's program 8 years ago and just really went to work on developing masculine relationship. And I give that the credit to my marriage, not just surviving, but thriving after 8.5 years. Yeah. In fact, I got into a men's program because knowing myself well enough, I knew without that, without men I was open with, vulnerable with, and getting support from and accountability from, I'd probably fuck this relationship up. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do it to me. I didn't want to do it to her. So I've got a lot of men in my life who know me well, who knows what's going on in my life, and they are there. And again, I give credit to the men in my life that have both held me accountable and just heard me and held me to help me grow in the ways I needed to grow to be a healthy, loving leader in the relationship with my wife. And I've watched her grow tremendously as I provided that kind of leadership in our relationship. But I needed men to do that. I have no doubt if I didn't have those guys in my life, this relationship would have ended probably about second or third year.
Yeah,
so
I see
I'm
that.
A big advocate, big fan, big advocate, especially for men. Again, women tend to have those support systems. We men don't. And like, you know, this workshop I did here, 8 guys in my office right behind me this weekend, you know, Friday night, same way. We just spent Friday night talking about why we're here. Why'd we pay a few thousand dollars, get on an airplane, fly to Mexico to come do this workshop with me? And I tell the guys, you're going to sit down tonight, looking around, you're measuring everybody, you're ranking everybody. We got our hierarchies. Oh, that guy's cool. That guy's a dick. Oh, that guy reminds me of someone I used to know. I wish that guy hadn't come. I'm not going to like him. I hope maybe that guy likes me. We're doing that. I said, and then by Sunday afternoon, you guys are going to feel like your frat brothers for the last 20 years. So sure enough, these guys show up Sunday morning. They all went out Saturday night. They've now all got nicknames. Every one of them has a nickname now. I go, And the one guy, my wife even commented Monday walking the dog. You know, the one guy referring to the one Indian guy there said, you know, he really changed on by Sunday. He was so, you know, this rigid and everything. He would just relax and open. I go, yeah, that happens. Yeah. These guys, they're still on a Signal chat thread with each other. They're blowing it up. You know, they've already set up a Zoom time to meet with each other. These guys love each other. They didn't know each other last Thursday.
Isn't that wild? How quickly?
And that is what happens if you give men a safe container, let them be real, let them be vulnerable. The irony is while we men are trying to hide all the things about us that we might think get a negative reaction from people, men and women both, the truth is when we start revealing ourselves that we don't want to reveal, people like us better. They relate to us. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen guys in workshops that I'm going, he's got enough tendencies about him to make him difficult to be around. Right. Mm-hmm. He does enough things that people kind of want to push them away, or they're so quiet they never enter in. But as soon as they start revealing themselves and showing their pain and their deepest hurt, all of a sudden, you really like them. You see past. I mean, those right. difficult patterns don't go away, but you see past them into their heart, their soul, and you go, I really care about that guy. I'm really cheering for that guy. I really want that guy to have the best. And you don't do that if we just keep bumping into each other's defense mechanisms. But once we get real and vulnerable and go have some fun and to just do, you know, dickish, stupid guy stuff and enjoy each other's company, you really develop a deepness. And these guys will bring that back to the world.
Right.
The ones that are in relationship to their women, some that were going through some pretty painful. One guy, the night he was flying out, he was up fighting with his wife till 2 a.m. They had to get on an airplane that morning over her infidelity that he'd known about since November, but not brought up.
No way.
He came here with that baggage.
Wow.
He left here smiling. He left here empowered. How it's going to work out with his wife, I don't know. But I suspect it's got a hell of a lot more chance than it did before he came.
Amen, because he has access to an integrated, grounded way of conversing about that and its alignment with values, its lack of alignment, what creates the circumstances for the infidelity, whatever it might be. But like to actually come back with some sense of direction that all I know I want is I want to embody these values and I want the relationships I create to embody those too. And if it doesn't, it's a no.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much clarity.
And you know,
create safety.
The guy got out of his head. I mean, he revealed early on, yeah, I'm always rehearsing the conversation, whether it's at work with my wife, because I think I have to, you know, convince him to give me what I want. I go, well, you're manipulating. Well, yeah. No, I just think I go, that's manipulation. Let's just call it that. And I said, so you're in your head all the time, pre-planning all the ways that you have to do X, Y, or Z to get everybody else around you to give you back what you want. And I started working with him about, you know, being the witness of his inner states and his feelings. And he said, I'm confused. I go, no, what we're talking about, it's not actually confusing. It's really simple. But you're so in your head and you're so afraid. By Sunday, this guy was just as open and transparent and could talk about his inner states of feeling. Like, what happened to this guy overnight? And then so much that my wife even noticed the difference of him, you know, through our house, you know, and their interactions, because she's around and, you know, kind of helping out with some stuff. And it's that transformative. Just all it took was, in this case, 12 hours or less with some other good men. And so, yes, to go back to your question, I'm a huge fan of men having that depth of connection with other men to show up in their relationships. And again, example, whenever I travel, going back to my second marriage, my second wife announced on our honeymoon, aren't you glad now that we're married, we don't have to pretend to like sex anymore? You know, I stayed 14 more years. And, wow. And the sex did not uptick any during that time. About halfway through the marriage, when I started taking better care of me, and I started taking road trips with some buddies, we'd go around the country and watch baseball games. Just, you know, four or five guys go to some city, Boston, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and just hang out with guys. Just guy time. You know, tell the same dumb joke over and over again, or say, that's what she said to, you know, everything that somebody, yeah. Just doing the dumb guy stuff. Watching baseball, hashing the games, you know, figuring out where we're going to go eat, just all that stuff. I'd come home and my ex-wife would say to me, you know, I'm so much more attracted to you when you come back. Mm. Well, not only had got my attention off of her and trying to please her and make her happy, I just had relaxed into my masculine and given her a chance to miss me, probably. And I just came back just filled with my masculine self, relaxed. And she just found that really attractive. And this is a woman who says, aren't you glad we don't have to pretend to like sex anymore? And so that was a pretty big statement on her part for her to even say, I find you attractive. So If you're actually in a relationship where your wife already finds you attractive and wants to be more attracted to you, I think having a good crew of men is the best thing, the best gift you can give your woman.
Yeah, I agree with that. It you then aren't sourcing everything from them, depending on everything from them. Also, I find, and I'm curious your thoughts, when you think of the pathology of what creates nice guy syndrome, it seems like safe spaces co-created with men where there is vulnerability, where there is this, where you're actually being held and witnessed. Do you find that it sort of coincides with the pathology of what creates the behavior?
Let me see if I can sort that out. I found that most nice guys do not have that. They don't trust men. Most nice guys I talk to say, yeah, I don't trust men. I'd rather be with women. I've lost a female friend.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
Often it began with father, at least for the older generations of nice guys, often reported that they were disconnected from their father. He wasn't there, divorced, worked all the time, or he was addicted or disconnected from feelings or abusive. Nowadays, I hear from a lot of millennials and Generation Z, their dad was a nice guy. And all he taught them was don't piss off their mother, because that's what he was trying to do as well, not piss off their mom. So, and I found that unless a man maybe had the experience through sports or military where he really found connection and shared experience with other men, so many men nowadays are disconnected from that. And it's part of our evolution. It's our tribal ancestors, the men spent time with men.
Yeah,
it's probably only been since World War II that men have spent less and less time with men and more time around women. And yeah. I'm not saying that that's right, wrong, good, or bad, but it has been a social shift since about World War II. And so that means for all of human history, except for the last 75 years, men have always spent most of their time in connection with men, which I think makes them more attractive to the feminine, whether we're talking about women or money or adventure or opportunity or any kind of feminine manifestation. Men spending time with men, I think, makes them more attractive. Now, I don't know if that's the question you were asking, but you can help me out if it wasn't.
No, that makes, maybe clearly my question.
And because nice guys don't have that, they're often not just inherently attractive to women or the feminine. So they go into what I call nice guy seduction. Oh, I'll listen to her talk about her problems. I'll do things for her. I'll be different than the other guys. I won't show any sexual interest. I'll repress it. I'll hide it, which often women may see that as a breath of fresh air if they've been with, you know, a number of jerks. But it doesn't actually turn them on, because there's nothing in there to turn the feminine on. And again, I think a big part of that is because the nice guy is not connected with his own sense of self, his own sense of masculinity. If dad had a penis, I better not have a penis. I got to be different from dad. If those bad men wanted sex and women complain about that, I better not want sex. So we don't have anything about us to just naturally attract a woman and keep her turned on over time if we do get into a relationship. So again, I don't know if I answered the question you were asking, but we'll keep taking stabs at it.
No, it makes sense. You know, that chameleon nature where you are a self that kind of like an on-demand self, you know, it's like, that's not going to be attractive. One, just the deep recognition that you're a shapeshifter. And although you might be meeting my immediate need for what I perceive as safety because you're non-threatening.
Yeah.
You know, it's not attractive. And
no, turn on there. Nice is boring. And I don't mean genuine kindness and caring is boring.
Exactly.
But the covert contracts of niceness. Oh, I'll never be a moment's problem. I saw a headline from a dating coach just the other day on an email. It says, being her butler won't turn her on. You know, basically doing everything for her and serving her will not turn her on.
No, it's an interesting, again, it's like when you talk about the nice guy behavior, which you said, that line rocked me when you said, I remember reading it, if you don't stand up to her, she won't believe you'll stand up for her.
Yeah.
And that, I was like, that makes so much sense why these experiences where I was almost being tested, like, are you in there, was really because they don't trust me with them, you know? And then of course, the infidelities are with men who, one, don't care that they're in a relationship. So they're willing to violate that, you know, the integrity of that for themselves, but they don't give a shit, you know, on some level. So they're like attractive because they're taking a stand, trying to seduce whatever it might be. And here I am, like, with no access to anger or rage. That's not attractive, because what's going to happen if someone attacks? I'm a little bitch, you know, on some level.
Yeah. And again, you know, I used to hear that from my ex. I had an experience. I always kind of get misty-eyed when I tell this, but this is probably towards the end of our marriage. But we had a house up above a golf course. We had some friends over. A couple couples came over for dinner. We had a barbecue. And that evening, we went down to play some little best ball golf. And I don't think any of us were very experienced golfers. I wasn't. My wife had never played golf. And, you know, it was evening time, not many people on the golf course. But we go down, and my wife was going to hit the first ball on the first tee. And I don't know what they call the guy, the steward, the sheriff, whatever.
The marshal.
The marshal. There you go. Yeah. He's out there. He starts yelling at her. And he was kind of an old crotchety guy, probably, I don't know, 60s or 70s. He starts yelling at her. I didn't say to go. You better not. Don't. And he was probably about 40 feet away, just kind of going off on my wife. And I walked over to him. This is one of those things. I'd already been doing some of my work for a while, but I still don't even know where this came from. I walked over to this guy. He probably had 20, 30 years on me. I got right in his face. And I said, listen, this is the first time she's ever played golf. I expect you to make this a positive experience for her. Do you understand me? I mean, I was just like that. And he goes, oh, yeah, sure. He goes over, kind of gets her in a stance, starts talking about how to take, and then, you know, told her how to hit the ball. And, you know, then we go on and we play a few holes. And later on that night, my wife comes to me and she says, thank you. I have never felt so loved in my entire life. Mm. Like I said, I still get misty-eyed thinking about that the things we think will make women feel loved. And it was something as simple as just taking a stand for her, mm-hmm, and standing up to somebody and telling them, make that a good experience. That's what they're wanting. And if we're thinking, oh, I got to, you know, just make them happy, don't upset them, don't rock the boat, go along to get along, that'll make them, no, that doesn't make them feel loved or protected or safe to where they want to open up and be vulnerable. A woman wants a man that can at least match their own power. And like I was saying, there's a lot of strong women out there. They don't want to feel like they're driving the bus. You know, they can, but they don't want that sense in the relationship. It doesn't create a polarity for them that they can just let go and open and be penetrated and be loved and fuck to God, whatever it might be. They've got to feel safe for that to happen.
One of the worst things for sleep is when you're too hot at night, right? Especially as the summer nights are getting hotter. And also, if your mattress is trapping heat, it might be time for a change. Now enter Avocado Green Mattress. It's luxuriously comfortable, naturally breathable, and it's made with certified organic materials. If you've been listening to the pod for a while, you know I'm all about high-quality organic products. And I love that Avocado uses certified organic latex, wool, and cotton. They're breathable, chemical-free, and perfect for a cooler sleep, especially in the summer. With comfort options from firm to plush, there's truly something for everybody and every sleep style. You can even take their mattress quiz, which is going to match you up with the perfect one for you. These mattresses are made to last. They have high quality craftsmanship that meets mission driven sustainability. Avocado isn't just about sleep. It's about a healthier life and a healthier planet. I trust Avocado because it's a certified B Corp and a leader in sustainable practices. Every decision they make from farm to finish is rooted in transparency and care. They're not cutting corners on your health or on environmental impact. Avocado mattresses are better for you and better for the planet. The best part about buying one is they have easy financing with Affirm. They offer a sleep trial up to one full year, and they have retail locations available so you can try it in person. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today and check out their mattress and bedding sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Now, I have empathy for women because if you basically look at it, here's their two choices. Asshole jerk, right? Patriarchal male, whatever. Over here, wussy doormat, snag, sensitive new age guy, simp, what nice guy, whatever. The asshole jerk is going to treat them bad, run around on them, steal their money, fuck their best friend, beat them, whatever. Sensitive new age guy is going to say, yes, dear, whatever you want. Be their girlfriend with a penis, basically.
Yeah.
You know, this is not attractive. This is attractive, but it's toxic. And so that's what women have had to choose from. That's it. That's really it. And I've got empathy for that. And so, you know, when men say, well, I don't want to be a nice guy, but I don't want to be this guy either. I got to find some middle ground. And I said, no, I don't know what the tipping point is between these two toxic extremes. Both of these guys are on the fight, flight, freeze spectrum, right?
Yeah.
This guy is just managing his anxiety through fighting, dominating. This guy's managing his anxiety through freezing, fleeing, and fawning. Mm-hmm. And neither one serve us or serve women. So we got to actually elevate to learn to release our shame, soothe ourselves, be self-differentiated. For men, have good connection with other men. Be purposeful. Know where we're going in life. Have good boundaries. Those are all different qualities of these two things mm-hmm. out here. This is very attractive to women. When I talk with women, you know, I'm on an airplane or whatever. Well, what do you do? And I'd say, well, you know, I work with men. Oh, really? Women perk up with that one. Really? Yeah. What do you do? Well, I teach men about relationships, whether it be dating or sex or that. Oh, what do you teach them? So, you know, I tell the women kind of what we're talking about. And, you know, they just like, where can I meet those guys? You know, can you put up a website that has these guys' names? Can I come wait in the parking lot of your workshop, you know, so to meet these guys? And another one of my favorite teary-eyed stories is I've got my granddaughter's turned 18 last October. You know, I've watched her grow up from a tiny baby, and I can't believe she's 18 now. And I've thought for a number of years, she's a strong woman. She's smart. At three, she understood figure of speech, metaphor, and reverse psychology. I mean, she just was that smart. At seven, I'm at there in a hot tub at her birthday, and she's telling me about natural selection and origin of the species. At eighth birthday, she's talking about Big Bang and the expanding cosmos. I go, do you watch Cosmos? Uh-huh. Like, doesn't everybody?
Yeah.
And she's an outdoor girl. I've got pictures of her with snakes grinning from ear to ear when she was like seven. She plays soccer, runs track. She's an honor student. So this is a woman fully in her power, in essence. And I've been saying for a few years, my goal is to create a planet, a world where my granddaughter has choices of men that aren't just this and aren't just that. And she's grown up with a father, my son, who's a very integrated man. He's a veteran of the Iraq War. He runs the experimental orchard at Washington State University. He's got a master's in wildlife ecology. He's strong. He was an AAU weightlifting champion at 15. And, you know, and he's just the best father. And she's got a grandfather that, you know, is somewhat strong and somewhat, you know, successful. And so she's grown up seeing that in men. Mm-hmm. And my son's the custodial parent. He divorced her mother when she was two, and he's been the custodial parent. So my goal was that my granddaughter and girls like her have a choice of good men, strong men, conscious men, open-hearted men, empowered men. And when I went to visit her on her 16th birthday, we're out having lunch, and she says, Grandpa, the boy that's taken me to the homecoming dance, his parents are reading your book. I thought, yeah. Victory.
That's amazing.
Goal, you know, yeah, mission accomplished that, you know, and how proud she must have felt. We said, yeah, that's my grandpa's book.
Yeah, so that's so cool.
We are creating a world where the young women of this world have choice now besides just this and this. They've got the strong, conscious, open-hearted men with purpose and passion who can lead and also who can listen. And, you know, so I just love what's happening in this world. I honestly believe we're going in a good direction.
I know
we were over here, swung way over here, but now I think we're going up here.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think there's been a beautiful movement of men supporting one another instead of desiring to be saved by women.
There you go. Good way to put it.
Yeah, called forward by women. Like, I think about all the conversations women in my past tried to have with me about some of the things I needed to shift, and it took me years to figure that out at the perfect time. But I think, yeah, I totally agree. There's a beautiful movement happening, and men are taking care of men and not making it the responsibility of others. And I love that dream that you have, because I am curious, what do you see as the pathology that leads women to be drawn to nice guys who are in that more manipulative, like people-pleasing kind, not true kindness, as you said, genuine kindness?
I don't know if it's pathology.
Yeah.
You know, again, I've listened to a lot of women, you know, being a marriage therapist for 25 mm-hmm. plus years. And this guy over here, the jerk, sociopath, whatever we're going to call him, is attractive. Mainly, he doesn't need her. He can't be tied down. There's a wildness maybe about him. Maybe they sense more of a power in him, but there's no heart, right? Mm-hmm. There's no consciousness with that. And I think what happens, maybe two things happen. One is women have enough experiences with that, and then they meet a guy who listens, who talks, who's supportive, who maybe even shows a little bit of vulnerability, who doesn't look like he's, you know, checking out every woman that walks by, like this guy. And they go, oh, this is a breath of fresh air. This feels good. And what I think they do is they talk themselves into liking him. They talk themselves into thinking, this is so much better than this. Now, they don't feel anything. They don't feel aroused. They don't feel like, I can't wait to fuck this guy's brains out. That's not the way women tend to feel towards the nice guy. Because again, they've just become the girlfriend with the penis. They're putting themselves smack in the friend zone, thinking, you know, if they're nice to the woman will like them. Because for men, if a woman's nice to us, we tend to really respond well to that.
Right.
So we
right.
think if yeah. we're nice to them, they'll respond well.
Yeah.
So what they do is, I think it just gives, I don't know if a breath of fresh air is the right word, but it just gives them what feels like something different than all the stress and anxiety. And what they're usually doing is telling this guy over here all the problems of their ex,
yeah.
and he's listening and trying to be not that ex. But what happens is, because there's a reverse polarity, he's almost the girl. And, you know, that's why I say girlfriend with a penis, because he's not bold. He's not leading. He's not setting the tone. He's not output penetrating the universe on his own. So they tend to get in the driver's seat, and they just start driving, and the guy gets in the passenger seat. So they've got a relationship. They tell themselves it's 50-50 and equal, because that's what kind of white educated people do nowadays. They said, no, we have to have 50-50 relationship. Okay. He's not being a jerk, so that means we're 50-50. And so she just gets behind the wheel and starts driving, and he's over in the passenger seat thinking, oh, I guess she wants to drive. I'll let her. Doesn't bother at all. Well, you want me to drive? And, you know, she doesn't trust that she can just let go of the wheel and he'll step over and leave. So she just keeps driving and he just keeps letting her. And it turns into a relationship, usually with very little passion, usually with him being hidden and secretive and hiding his porn from her. And you know, her feeling more and more dry and an edge, and like she's got to do everything, and less wanting to have sex. It just feels like one more burden to take care of this needy little boy's empty place in him. And that can go on actually for quite some time. It did in my relationships, and I've seen it go on quite some time in other relationships, until the woman either cheats on him or at just some point just realizes she is so fucking miserable, she can't do it any longer. And part of the problem is she keeps saying, you know, all her friends think he's a great guy. You know, he's a good catch. He's not like the jerks that she used to go with. But she does catch him in lies. She does catch him looking at the pornography. She does, you know, find out he's not really, you know, who he says or tries to. But, you know, they've been together. She doesn't really want to go back to the jerks. I'm kind of painting a picture that I don't know if that fits mm-hmm. across the board. But I don't know that it's a pathology. I think it's more just like, I can't do this anymore. I can't put up with the lies, the infidelity, the abuse, the, you know, just all the stuff they get from the jerk boyfriend. And so they either go alone, you know, there's a lot of women on their own out there. A lot of women not in a relationship these days, because these are the only two choices.
Yeah, there's no option.
They've tried them both. They've tried them both, and they'll go, you know, they'll be the proverbial cat lady, I guess. and they'll go bury themselves in their job, their career, and because they've been told that's really where they're going to get their identity and their value anyway, and until they realize it doesn't really give them their value and their identity. But by then, they're 45, 50 years old, and, you know, going, where are the good, I want a good man in my life. Where are they? By the time they hit 45 or 50, there's no good men out there looking for where they're at, for that kind of woman.
I'm curious, what do you think is the response or responsibility in the dynamic where one, let's say, is more operating in that disconnected, masculine, oppressive role that the feminine gets into in that circumstance, and the man's in the more accommodating, people-pleasy stuff? I think for a lot of people-pleasers who maybe take on more of the self-perception or the power dynamic of martyrdom.
Oh, yeah. Easy to do.
Yeah. So how do you sort of like manage this because of course I think for the martyr it's like, but they're like this. The yeah. woman is disconnected, she's oppressive,
she's mean,
she's
that,
avoidant,
yeah.
she's yeah. so like how do we move out of the martyrdom and call that forward where they're also taking responsibility if we're still in a relationship dynamic?
Here's where I believe in couples therapy. Couples yeah. counseling. I'm a couples therapist by training. I've done it for a long time. Einstein said something along the lines of the thinking that created the problem we're in is not going to get us out of the problem that we're in. We have to go put ourselves in a context where somebody can see our relationship and interactions differently than how we see them. Because mm-hmm. especially in a couples relationship, yeah, most people usually walked into my office with one of two scenarios. They're both pointing at the other one saying, is him, is her, or they're both pointing at one of them. Often the guy, is him, yeah, it's me. Yeah. Occasionally the woman, but usually the woman won't take that role on by herself. Of, yeah, we both agree I'm the terrible one. Unless maybe she cheated or something. But often then the feminine can actually justify that and say, it's his fault. So I have found if you get them in therapy, one thing I found is that in couples therapy, you cannot start with the woman. She'll bolt. I heard a talk by Terry Real several years ago, and he's an acknowledged feminist and a pretty high-paid couples therapist. I think he's worked with some big celebrities. I heard him say, you can't start with a woman. She'll bolt. And when I was working with couples, when they came in my office, I'd say, what else have you guys done? Oh, we saw another therapist or two. And I said, well, how'd that go? Oh, we went a time or two, but didn't go back. Occasionally, I would ask, whose decision was it to not go back? 100% of the time, the woman's. 100%. Now, we have this myth that women drag their husbands kicking and screaming into therapy. That is kind of how it was when I started as a marriage therapist. By the time I quit having private practice, it was the men dragging the women kicking and screaming into therapy.
Interesting.
And the women bolting from it if they were held with any kind of accountability. So my approach was always start with the guy. And I'd liken the analogy. I learned a salsa dance in my 40s and 50s. And one of the hardest things I've ever done as a white guy with no rhythm is and a nice guy who'd never led anything. My teachers and partners, I had this one great teacher, a lesbian teacher. And she said, Robert, you've got to give her clear direction of where you're going. You've got to let her know. I go, oh, I can do that. I can lead. So I would use the analogy of dance that I said, okay, I can start with the woman in this relationship and teach her how to follow using the dance analogy. But if the guy doesn't know any steps and doesn't know how to lead, who's she going to follow? It's better I start with the guy, teach him a few steps, get him confident with those few steps, and then bring his partner in and teach her how to follow. Now, again, this is somewhat gender-based, but in dance, you always have a lead and a follow. Now, it might be a man. It might be a woman. You know, again, some of my best teachers were either gay or lesbian. They could dance either way. And so I would say, let's start with the guy. And I would start talking about really all the kind of things we've been talking about his need to be conscious and present, about his need to tell the truth, about his need to stand up for himself, his need to have boundaries, his need to lead, her sense of security and well-being. And I would start, you know, just working with a guy on this stuff. I cannot tell you how many women either looked at me or looked at their partner and go, I like him. He understands women. So mm-hmm. they knew I understood their need for security, for the honesty of the man, for him truly showing up, for him leading, for him risking her wrath, for him being bold and having a life and having guy friends and not depending on her for all his validation and connection. So the women really liked that. They loved it when I got a guy up and worked him through the boundary exercise. And I had women clap when I did boundary work with the guy. And the guys go, "You mean you want me to stand up to you, dear?" She goes, "Of course I do. I don't want to think I can walk all over you." And I tell the guy, she's telling you the truth. She wants to know you're strong enough to set a boundary with her. But the very first boundary you set with her, she's going to challenge it. She's going to push through it. And you're going to go, "I thought you wanted me to stand up to you, dear." And she's going to say, "I do, just not this one." And I said, she's got to challenge it. Now, here's what I found. When I started with the guy, instead of just talking about what are their problems and whose fault is it, I start talking with the guy about the stuff I generally saw that men did, and I'd listen to where they were at, and then I'd start with the guy. Once I started with the guy, often before the first session was even up, the woman would start going, "You know, I'm not the easiest person to live with. Mm-hmm. You know, I can be pretty harsh. I can be pretty reactive." Yeah, and the woman, once she felt a sense of safety, in that she knew I was going to, you know, work with the man in a way that she's been trying to tell him one way or another that that's what she wants, but he doesn't get it coming from her. And he just thinks he's doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. And how do I get her over being upset at me? And that's all she's been getting. She feels safe enough that with me, maybe even now with him, that he might like set some boundaries. He might, you know, have a sense of self. She starts ratting herself out and telling where she's not easy to live with and where she can be difficult. And so I've found that that model seems to work really well for helping couples get unstuck. And then I just go to work with the guy and I'll say, "How are you in this relationship in ways that are less than functional or less than loving? Let's go to work on that. Let's take your focus off of her." And I have found consistently when the guy goes to work on that stuff, the woman follows that lead. It creates what I call the relationship teeter-totter. When one person starts growing and challenging themselves, even if this person wants it, they get insecure. They get anxious. Oh, they're growing. They're going to have other choices. They might leave me. So this person, if they don't want to be left, they'll either try to bring the person back down. They'll sabotage it. Or maybe they'll start challenging themselves to grow. And then maybe as they're growing, this person goes, "Oh, they're growing. They have more choices. They're going to be more attractive. They might could leave me. I better, you know." And then you create this upward spiral, in a sense, of two people's personal growth, challenging and supporting and modeling to the other the same thing. You know, I mentioned when I married my wife, I got into a men's program. And my coach soon said, "Robert, Lupita, you got to get Lupita into therapy." And I go, "Mexicans don't do therapy. They drink." And he goes, "Oh, yeah." But I told her, I said, "You've got to find a counselor." And I said, "I don't know how you can do it." And 2 weeks later, she goes, "I found a counselor." It was a kid's school counselor who did private counseling. And that's, you know, for the last 8 years, in ways different than me, she's done her own work. And I see her personal growth and how the things that used to trigger her and caused her to, you know, withdraw or lose control, they might still trigger her, but she'll just tell me about it now rather than withdrawing or going off on me. And she'll just say, "Can I tell you something?" I'll go, "Yeah." She'll tell me. I'll go, "Thank you for telling me that." And we're done. Mm. And I'm thinking, that's because both of us, I started that growth teeter-totter and she stayed on the teeter-totter and she's constantly challenging herself to grow as well. So we've had some pretty toxic exchange between ourselves because of her wounding and my wounding and how we're a perfect storm for each other, like a lot of couples are. And the beauty of that is we've used each other to work through a lot of that old stuff and, you know, both clean out the trauma, but also learn new, healthier ways of relating and communicating. So that's how I think you do it. Good luck trying to do it on your own. Even maybe good luck trying just one of you go to a coach and trying to.
Yeah.
I think the two of you got to get with a good systems therapist who can understand the system the two of you created. I'm trained to look at whatever's going on between a couple, let's say, exists because both people need it to exist that way. Otherwise, it wouldn't exist that way. like Carl Jung said, having is evidence of wanting. The way I was trained to look at the same thing is that we've invited that person into our life to recreate something old so that we can work it out. And I believe that's probably what relationships are primarily for. I don't actually think they're for what we think they are, you know, to give us a lifetime loving partner and raise kids and live happily ever after. I don't think they're actually built to do that, but they are
totally
built
agree.
To be powerful personal growth machines because they're not the something natural in our DNA. So I'm thinking if a divine creative cosmos wanted to create the most personal growth in these things called humans, he would give them a strong sex drive and make up some rules that they've got to pair bond for life.
I totally agree, man. I think it's the material that comes forth in romantic relationship is some of the only material we're willing to change for. Like, I think love matters to us enough that we'll actually look at our stuff most of the time. You know, yeah. I love that you said about the teeter-totter, because when I always joke with my wife that we play leapfrog, like one does the growth, invites the other one forward. And
beautiful.
It's almost like you spend a lifetime of just saying yes to the invitations to each other if we're willing to do that. I mean, I wish I had learned this stuff when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, but it's never too late. It's the perfect time.
How are you going to learn that at 12? I mean,
right?
Who teaches it and what context would you even try to apply it to?
Right.
No, we learn it when we learn it. And, you know, none of us have ever been here before. So everything we do is like an experiment in the dark. And I've been telling people, you know, I was telling a client just earlier before I was talking to you, I said, you know, I'm a marriage and family therapist who's been divorced twice and married three times. And, you know, I actually don't get much flack about that. I don't get a lot of, well, who are you? You know, if you've been divorced twice, why would I come, you know, why would I take relationship advice from you? Because I just own it. I've bumbled my way through every relationship I've ever had. And so I'm actually speaking to the choir. I'm speaking to a population of people who go, me too, me too, me too. There's nobody out there going, yeah, I got this whole relationship thing handled. I've got it down.
Don't trust those people.
No. And the only people I know who kind of indicate that, you know, hey, they're usually saying it was pure dumb luck that I met an amazing person that, you know, has just brought out the best in me. So, you know, almost nobody claims it's because I'm so goddamn good at relationship, I have no problems. Usually just go, nah, she's an angel, or he's a saint, or, you know, whatever. So they give the credit to the other. So we're meant to bumble our way through this stuff. And again, yeah, if we can see our partner as a gift that we invited into our life and that they are just acting in loving ways by giving us exactly what we need to work through our old shit, then we're going to go, thank you, dear, for cheating on me. It was just what I needed to go to work on my old stuff. Now, granted, that's going to take a lot of attainment in order to be able to bring that kind of, you know, energy to it. But at least we can point ourselves in the direction of being outcome agnostic, to being equally okay with every possible outcome, to saying thank you for every struggle that presents itself, going, let's work with this, let's dance with it. And that can take almost any relationship and make it memorable, make it powerful.
Amen. Oh man, that's so true. Dr. Robert Glover, I feel like I could talk to you forever. I'm so grateful that I've developed the courage to get the introduction to you. And
I'm glad you reached out.
I hope that you'll accept my invitation to come back on. I would love to do this again.
Next time you've got a big event and you want to celebrate it, ask me to come back. We'll talk some.
Oh, man, that'd be amazing. For the people listening, where can they find more of you, the details about retreats, all that kind of stuff?
Okay. DrGlover.com is my website. Under construction right now. It's coming along, almost there. For workshops, consultation, training programs. IntegrationNation.net is my men's membership program. So if you're a guy looking for a place to go get that kind of connection we're talking about, Integration Nation. So drglover.com, IntegrationNation.net.
Perfect. Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and all the intentional self-awareness that you've put in and then alchemized into the education for others. So I appreciate it.
Thanks for the invite. I had fun. I look forward to doing it again.
Me too.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, It opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.